Good morning. Well, it has been some week on Wall Street. At the moment, the market is down about 71 points at 16,582, and many are very unsure what to make of the fluctuations this week. Is it a crisis or a correction? Later this hour, stock market researcher Dr. David Hunter gives us his analysis, and the legal effort to stop cane burning takes some fire from HCNS General Manager Rick Vollner. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
I'm Chris Vandercook. And John Patrick Shanley's storefront church completes what he calls his Church and State trilogy. It's a new actors group production. And a seasoned photographer offers a series of Pacific New Media workshops for shooters who want to take their work to the next level.
It's Friday, August 28th. The conversation starts right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation for this Aloha Friday. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
Looking at the pros and cons of cane burning.
Yeah, and we've been doing that for a while. We're going to continue that conversation this morning. Now, on Maui, the practice of cane burning consternation has turned to anger. A community group took it to the courts with a lawsuit filed earlier this summer and more recently an injunction scheduled for hearing next month. The director of the Department of Health and Alexander and Baldwin, the parent company of Hawaiian Commercial and Sugar Company, are named as defendants. The premise is the legal challenge of the legal challenge is a violation of public trust by disregarding public health, according to the group Stop Cane Burning. But HCNS takes a very different view, and General Manager Rick Vollner is in our studio this morning to talk about it with us. Thank you for being here. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Thank you for having us.
When we talked with the attorney for Stop Cane Burning, the central issue that they say is just something that HCNS is disregarding is public trust, and that's being violated because of the health concerns over the cane burning, in part because not only just the sheer volume of smoke that's coming out, but because of the use of glyphosate on the plants before they're burned, and that when it's liberated, it's causing a different element to be present in the smoke. How do you answer them?
Well, first of all, as a fifth generation Maui resident, my great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents actually came to Hawaii to work on the sugar plantation. So it's, to me personally, I'm very saddened to see a lawsuit like this take place, challenging a agricultural tool that's used widely across all 50 states throughout the world. And this practice of agricultural burning is critical to the success of our sugar operation on Maui. It's critical to the success of many agricultural operations across the nation. The issue with glyphosate, we've been using ripeners. The entire sugar industry has been using ripeners for decades. So this is not a new issue. This is not something that just started. The use of ripeners is prevalent throughout the sugar industry, not only here in Hawaii, but throughout Florida, Louisiana, Texas, all places that utilize ripeners and utilize agricultural burning as part of their harvesting techniques.
Part of the conversation about the tradition of cane burning, as you've talked about it, is that, though, that the changes in how it's done have to do with what chemicals are put on the plants. So that cane burning, say, in 1920 isn't the same thing as cane burning in 1980. When you talk about the ripeners that are used, the glyphosate, how much is actually used per acre?
It's a very small amount. Less than a coffee cup of material is actually applied per acre, of which the glyphosate, the active ingredient, is a very small percentage of that. So it's a very minute amount that's used in the ripener, but it's critical to getting that sugarcane ripened to the point where it's ready for harvest, especially in Hawaii where weather can be very unpredictable.
So what do you say to an organization like Stop Cane Burning that says, but public health is at risk because of this?
I would say that there are no studies that show that this is a public health risk. In fact, there are studies that were conducted going back to the late 80s, you know, in Hawaii, specifically at HCNS, by HIOSH, by NIOSH, CDC, University of Hawaii, that all show that there are no health risks for our employees, our workers, or even the general public.
And in places around the world where glyphosate is questionable?
Again, glyphosate as a herbicide is widely used. In fact, it's the most popular herbicide around the world because it is a very effective herbicide, very cost-effective, as well as the efficacy. When you're doing a crop management program, if used properly, all herbicides, you know, if used properly, are a tool for farmers. And we utilize glyphosate, again, as a ripener. We also utilize it as a herbicide from time to time in our fields. We have not seen anything that shows us that it's dangerous. We continue to look at the best available information and make decisions. Like any good business, like any good farmer, you're continuously looking to improve your operation, look at better tools for you to utilize.
If next month the injunction happens and you're stopped from doing business as you've been doing it with the cane burning, what we have heard is that will mean the loss of jobs. When Lance Collins was here talking about filing that injunction, he said that, well, that's a spurious argument because the industry has been looking at shutting down anyway because of market forces with sugar, and that, you know, that may happen simply because of another reason entirely. What's your counterargument to that?
We obviously, as a business, are always looking at external forces. You're always looking at production levels, always looking at pricing. Sugar is obviously a very challenging business. There are many low-cost producers around the world that we have to compete with. But agriculture in general is a very tough business. So as we look at how best to utilize our lands, we're always looking at what could be the next best crop that we could grow? What could be the next best thing we could utilize on our resources? We've long said that we're not a sugar company. We're an agricultural company that happens to be growing sugarcane at this time. Should the injunction or this lawsuit be successful, it would be devastating to the sugar business. We would not be able to continue farming sugarcane in the Central Valley of Maui, and that would be devastating, you know, to HCNS and to the local economy.
Are you looking, though, at other crops? Because the market forces aren't necessarily going to change, as you just mentioned. A lot of places are growing it far more cheaply than can be done on Maui, despite the long, 140-year history that it's been done. So what do you look at as being next as that transition to something that you would hope would be more profitable and, well, that would keep a lot of jobs still there on Maui?
I tell people all the time, and sometimes I get strange looks, but we literally planted the first sugarcane crop 143 years ago, and 142 years ago, we started looking at alternatives, and that's what good businesses, that's what good farmers do. You're always looking for how best you could utilize your resources, the land, the water, the people that you have available, and that's been our philosophy from the very beginning, and we continue to look at ways that we could better utilize our resources, better utilize agricultural land. We are committed at Alexander and Baldwin and at HCNS to keep 36,000 acres in agriculture in the Central Valley of Maui, preserve jobs, you know, do the things that we think are necessary to keep Maui, our home, the way it is.
So, Rick, does that mean that you're looking at issues of food security and growing food? Or does that mean that you're looking at, say, feedstocks or both of those things, given the fact that you've got some real variance in what you can grow on those acres?
We are looking at a diverse portfolio of things that could help with both food and energy security. We've been extremely focused over the last few years looking at biofuels production with our central kind of core lands. And we feel that we can grow feedstock very well, better than anyone else probably in the world. But what's really missing at this point is that technology to take that agricultural feedstock and turn it into a high-value biofuel, an advanced biofuel like drop-in jet fuel or marine diesel. But that still is a very critical part of our strategy as we look at redeploying those lands.
Do you have any timeline for that kind of transition?
We are still, again, looking at technologies that could make that possible.
Or even the food side of it, because we always hear that we don't grow enough to be able to feed ourselves. We've got some great agricultural land that's not being used for the benefit of feeding people and putting food on their tables.
Yeah. Any transition at HCNS would basically result in transitioning all of our acreage. As soon as we start taking out significant portions of lands from sugarcane production, it really changes the economics of the business because we have so many fixed costs embedded in the business, the mill, the power plant, the infrastructure. So taking out significant acreage for food production or biofuels production would really signal or really require the transition of all the acreage into a diversified portfolio.
But if we're talking to each other, let's say 3 years from now, do you see that there would be a transition already in place? But again, that's, I know you're going to tell me it's based on the technology part of it, but from what you know of where that is, do you have any bead on when that might be?
I could not give you a definite answer, but I would say in the future, again, we're an agricultural company. I expect HCNS to be, you know, a part of the Maui community going forward, and probably most likely growing something other than sugarcane for both energy and food.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much for coming over.
Thank you.
To be here. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Rick Vollner is the general manager of HCNS. He was born and raised on Maui. He is treasurer of the Maui County Farm Bureau, president of the Hawaii Agricultural Research Center. The injunction to stop cane burning is scheduled to be heard on September 16th.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:15, and later in the show, what happens when you set up a storefront church and the time comes to pay the rent? But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're cruising down a long causeway, almost half a mile long. It was built in 1906 to connect two tidal flat islands on Kahololoa Reef, which fronted the original natural harbor of Honolulu. As the little town grew into Hawaii's largest city, portions of the reef were dredged, and this enlarged the tidal islands. Now, back in 1868, a ship from the Far East brought passengers who'd been exposed to smallpox. A year later, Kamehameha III's government built a permanent quarantine station on that islet, and by 1888, enlarged by dredging, it was renamed Quarantine Island. In 1902, the U.S. Pacific Health Service took it over, adding a hospital. By 1906, dredging enlarged Quarantine Island to 38 acres, and some of the pump sand made a separate little island with a pier for ships with passengers who might have contagious diseases. The island was also isolated from Honolulu proper and was called Quarantine Wharf. It connected to Quarantine Island by an almost half a mile long causeway. And our question for today is, what's the name of that causeway? If you know it, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Nohea Gallery and Kaiser Permanente.
Playwright John Patrick Shanley's characters are often in conflict with one another and with themselves. His plays are dramas of ideas with characters whose internal struggles mirror our own. Storefront Church, a new production of the Actors Group that opens next week in Honolulu, is described by the playwright as a mortgage crisis that brings about a spiritual crisis. Kathy Bowers is the director, and she joins us this morning. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning.
This is a playwright who is really good at kind of conveying the complexity of character, isn't he?
Yes, he is. Yeah. All of the characters in his plays have their own struggles and are very complex.
So that's a challenge both for you as director and for the actors, right?
That's true. That is very true.
So how do you prep actors for roles like these?
I've been lucky, very lucky, in when we've had auditions for plays. I was particularly lucky with this one, having the quality of actors come in.
So step one, get good actors.
Right, right. Yeah. Makes my job as a director an awful lot easier. I don't have to teach them about the craft.
Yeah.
What I do with a play normally is I let the actors tell me what they see.
Mm-hmm.
And by the first run through of the play is I don't do a lot of, quote, blocking. Mm-hmm. I see what the characters have to say.
Yeah.
And what they would do, what they think they would do. And then we begin to refine that process.
Mm-hmm.
I let them do it unless I believe what they're doing is in conflict with what I see the playwright as wanting to get across to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes it very interesting. Our discussions are incredible. After we've gone through a scene, we'd sit and talk about it. And layer upon layer upon layer is revealed. And it is just, it's so stimulating to be a part of the process.
It works so much better when the actors arrive at their own conclusions.
It does. It does.
You hear so often about directors who, you know, go so far as giving line readings, and that can make actors feel as if they're just sort of, you know, ventriloquist dummies a little bit, yeah?
Yeah, it can.
At its worst, right?
At its very worst, right. There are times when I have to correct the emphasis in something. Mm-hmm. Somebody misreads. It's like saying, how are you versus how are you?
Mm-hmm.
And there are times when a certain emphasis is clearly indicated in the play, that kind of thing. But most of what the characters do with the dialogue comes from their knowledge of the character. And I'm very lucky to have people that spend a lot of time with their character.
Does the playwright give you help in terms of the stage direction, the descriptions of the characters in the text?
Oh, yes. Yes, there's a lot. We have one of the characters who's he's described as having a facial deformity.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got to work that into his makeup so he can appear that way. And he's doing a marvelous job.
Because some playwrights don't give you a lot of help beyond the lines themselves.
That's correct. But
right?
Shandley does give you a certain amount. But he certainly does not deliver you a complete character, and this is how you're supposed to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he gives he gives credit to the actor for their ability to do that.
And thereby keeps his work alive, I think.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So tell me about the situation that kind of gets things going in this play.
Okay. Jessie Cortez has made the space below her apartment available to a young minister who wants to open a storefront church. He feels that that's what he's been led to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then she takes out a second mortgage on her place to give him money to renovate. And he comes to a spiritual crisis of his own and can't do anything else. He's spent the money. He hasn't started having services and has no way to pay the rent.
Does he just not feel qualified to be instructing people when he's having a crisis of his own?
No, I don't think so. He is paying attention to what he believes God is telling him to do, mm-hmm. whether or not it looks good to others.
Mm-hmm.
And Jessie Cortez believes in him and does not think that he's trying to pull something over. A lot of other people in the play do think he's trying to pull something over. And that conflict is certainly central to the play.
Well, his hesitation puts everybody in a pretty awkward place.
Yes, yes, it does indeed. They are each of the characters that comes into it is connected with it in some way. There's a loan officer. There's Jesse's husband. There is the Bronx borough president who happens, his mother happens to be a friend of Jesse's. Mm-hmm. And then there's the minister and the bank president who holds the mortgage. So all of these people come together in this story to with their own baggage, so to speak. And it's just very compelling to watch how this, and it doesn't really get resolved. That's one of the things about Chandler. He leaves a lot of things to you to decide as an audience member.
Plenty to think about as you leave the theater.
Right. Then.
Great. Sounds like it must be a lot of fun to put this production together.
I just feel like I have to pinch myself every once in a while because I'm doing what I just love.
Well, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Kathy Bowers is the director of the Actors Group production of Storefront Church by John Patrick Shanley. It runs September 4th through 20th at the Brad Powell Theater in Eveleigh. And you can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Breeze rustling a bamboo grove, a quiet room full of memory. Darren Miyashiro, Sandy Tsukuyama, and Chris Molina take you there in an evening of contemporary Japanese koto and shakuhachi music on August 29th. A unique concert of exquisite artistry in HPR's Atherton Studio, Saturday the 29th, 7:30 p.m. Call 955-8821 during business hours or go to hprtickets.org.
T is for true. And here's what we know to be true. Donations from individuals account for 62% of this station's revenue. New members often start out at the True Believer level, giving $10 a month. Mahalo to Malia and Dolan Eversole of Honolulu, William Orr of IAEA, and Alice Lee of Honolulu for their recent membership gifts. So, how about you? Won't you become an HPR member today? You can by calling us at 955-8821 during business hours or go online and donate at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Pacific University, celebrating 50 years of educating students from Hawaii, the mainland, and around the world, offering 50 undergraduate and 14 graduate degrees. hpu.edu.
If you've tried to get anywhere on some of Hawaii's main roads, particularly on Oahu, you know it's taking you longer. And with projections for even more people and even more cars in future coming to the state, the trip to and from work is going to take more time. So why aren't more companies offering workers the chance to telecommute? Civil Beat Deputy Editor Eric Pape takes a look in today's Reality Check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Now, for a long time, the promise of the all the good things and benefits that both company and workers could reap from telecommuting seemed to be getting a lot of steam. We saw a lot of flex time and other parts to how we deal with each other based on technology, but it doesn't seem to be really taking up or taking root in Hawaii. How come?
Well, our columnist Jason Rushen asks this question, and he explores it in his column today. And I think it's a great question, because we have a cost of living issue here in Hawaii that I'm often talking about with you. And this could resolve a lot of that. But before we get to some of that, I think some of the reasons have to do with perception, a change of culture, from what he writes and also from my own experiences. You need a change of culture in Hawaii where you are evaluated on the work that you produce more than being present and more than just sort of showing up. I think it was Woody Allen who once said that 80 or 90% of life is just showing up. That really shouldn't be the case in the workplace. It should be about what you do. But some bosses seem to think you have to be in front of them showing that you're exerting yourself rather than just delivering.
When you talk about, you know, creation of producibles that you can point to and say, you know, here's the work, that being the test for it. But there's also the issue of availability to other coworkers. Technology has changed that. People FaceTime each other and talk other in other ways from, you know, just simply being across a desk or across a table. That still goes back to an idea that maybe there's not as much control if somebody is working at home. Maybe they're, you know, only working when you're FaceTiming them.
Yeah, no, that could be true, but if you are evaluated on what you delivered, that's another matter. But this isn't something that can be done in every single field. You know, a plumber can't plumb remotely.
If only he would be a very wealthy person if he could.
Yeah, exactly. But so it's not everywhere. But if we look at the economy in Hawaii and where there's potential for the most growth, and where companies that already exist might be able to save money and perhaps even improve salaries to allow people to afford to live here, I think it's very much worth considering the times when they are just being overly controlling. Now, the human interaction is still important. Even in Silicon Valley, face-to-face meetings are important. But the truth is, you know, in our offices, we're often Skyping and messaging each other, and we sit right next to each other. There's a lot less talking about everything, and there's a lot more focusing on talking face-to-face when that's a useful and helpful thing.
Okay, I mean, that's a whole sociological phenomenon that you and I could talk long and hard about. But when it comes to real data that shows what this might mean for Hawaii, is there any yet?
It's hard to measure what the possible benefits would be to Hawaii from telecommuting, because it's all a question of the scale. But if you look at our traffic, the average person spends over 50 hours a year in traffic. If we had people working from home more, that would reduce that. If we look at rents, business rents, which are very high in Hawaii, if there was less space needed for people to work in their offices, those companies would have more money to invest in other things, like maybe their staff or maybe growing their company.
And there are companies which have gone totally virtual, but we're going to have to leave it at that for the moment because we're out of time. Sorry.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go work from home now.
All right. Have a good day.
Thank you very much.
Bye, Eric. And thanks very much for being with us this week. Eric Pape is a deputy editor of Civil Beat. You may be thinking it's a Friday, but in our minds, it's also a Monday in the start of the next week, which means that our news department is already looking at what you'll be hearing when we hit next week. News Director Bill Dorman joins us now for a preview. One of the things you're going to be talking about is transparency, but this time it's not about government.
Yeah, you know, transparency is something we talk a lot about in terms of journalism generally, but this one is a question of glass and transparency. And
the real transparency.
It is true. If you're putting up buildings in Kaka'aka these days, critical set of questions around transparency. The Hawaii Community Development Authority has rules about this, about light through glass, concerns something called visual light transmission. And the idea basically comes down to what light comes through, what light is reflected, and then also the impact that has on people in other buildings and also even down to people on the road. The rules themselves, pretty clear, but the application has not been. So there's sort of through a glass darkly. So in the case of the Symphony Honolulu, which wants an exception on this, HCDA has been wrestling with this, what to do. Decision due next week. It's got implications for other buildings as well. 801 South Street now wants an exemption. So we should be getting an update on Wednesday on sort of where this all goes from here.
I mean, a lot of drivers have had the experience of, you know, looking ahead and suddenly something is keying off another building and you have just a little blind spot there, or you just look at this and you can't even feature the entire cityscape because you're looking at light glinting off of glass.
It's true, but then are you talking about like pulling out all of the glass that's already there and redoing it? I mean, it's an interesting.
How far
set
do you go?
Questions. Yeah, yeah. So Wayne Yoshioka will be on that, and up the road a little bit, UH. You know, we do different kinds of stories about UH from time to time. Bit of a different look from Noe Tanigawa next week on the idea of what's popular with students in terms of majors that are trending higher, classes that are picking up buzz, and how that's changed really in the recent past. What is most popular, and a look at sort of overall enrollment questions as well. So that should be interesting.
All right, and we're going to check in with the Hokulea.
Hokulea, quite a time of it lately. You know, part of their safety drills and ongoing practices is what to do if somebody goes overboard. They recently had that situation in real life. And now they've just left an isolated atoll. And just this morning, after a journey of 1,000 miles to get there, now the next leg is about 2,300 miles to Mauritius. And so Molly Solomon will be talking to them, and we'll get an update and hear exactly what they're up to this week.
And all coming up next week.
You betcha.
Thanks so much. Yeah. Bill Dorman is HPR's news director.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Straub Clinic and Hospital, Infinity of Honolulu, and Gourmet Events Hawaii.
Sometimes it's really good to be looking at a Friday, especially this week. On Monday, American stock markets plunged. The Dow alone opened at an historic drop of over 1,000 points. And over this week, financial folk have been trying to help the rest of us make some sense of it and the market's movements in the global context. We called David Hunter from the UH Sidler School of College of Business for a scholarly approach. And Professor Hunter joins us now in our studio. Good morning. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning.
It's always a tough thing when people see movements like this, and this one in particular, because we really hadn't seen a movement like this close to it in 2010, but not like over 1,000 points in this way. And the big question that is on everyone's lips is this: is this just a correction, or is this really another crisis?
The markets are always forward-looking, and so it's hard to say at this point if it really might be a crisis. That could always happen. But at least all the indicators right now would suggest that it doesn't appear to be so. Right now, growth in the U.S. is still positive. There's very low unemployment. Most of the crisis seems to be more out of fears for potentially lowering interest rates by the Fed. And the crisis in China also seems to have had some effect.
Watching what happened in China and seeing that 8.5% drop, and then seeing that there's real issues happening in the EU, with the EU, and knowing that the Fed is just waiting for the right moment to be able to raise interest rates. Those things, the confluence of all those things, obviously gave us what we saw this week. But how much of that do you see, if you could disentangle it and say, okay, as we move forward, there may be some other issues that we should just expect as a matter of course, as opposed to seeing elements simply colliding and producing a crisis?
Well, the main thing to keep in mind is that corrections are normal. The reason stock markets earn high returns is because there is some element of risk. And so you should expect that risk. You should expect that there will be, on bad news, there will be occasional times when markets are down. And that's just the normal course of things. You see it in this week. It was sudden fears on the first 2 days, but all of a sudden the markets realized that things weren't so bad. And so the subsequent 2 days, things improved and corrected very quickly.
Was it unrealistic when, you know, the Dow was well above 18,000? I mean, was that just a false high?
I think that when people are expecting high growth, I think that 18,000 of the Dow would be very reasonable. It really comes down to what you should expect in future growth. And when, you know, we do see, obviously, in the late 1990s with the dot-com crisis, obviously, internet companies were valued much too high. But, you know, leading up to that, expectations were very, very positive for internet companies. And so, you know, those high values were arguably sustainable. Now, with hindsight, we learned that that was probably not the case. But I think there's some very positive things looking forward for the U.S. economy. And for that reason, you know, the market values may very well be legitimate, may be sustainable.
In what sector in particular? I mean, as you just, you know, look in the market, because looking at the history of, well, we saw the dot-com crisis happen, but before mm-hmm. that, everything was looking so great, and all anybody could talk about were dot-coms, and, you know, people were calling things like amazing Amazon, I mean, all those things that we were talking about then. Mm-hmm. And now, looking at how life has changed a little bit, a lot, and what bubbles may exist that we don't really understand well now, because we don't have the blessings of hindsight yet, but as you say, the market's always forward-looking. What do you see in terms of market sectors that might potentially be a problem?
One thing I teach in my class is that you have to avoid just having a single focus view. If you're picking just a single sector, you may be right, you may be wrong, and it's more a function of luck, because, you know, things change very quickly. It's much more prudent to look at a diversified portfolio, to try and look at, you know, on the margin you may over-allocate to an industry that you think looks more appealing, but you shouldn't bet your entire portfolio on that, because it just increases the risk of loss to you. Even in a good market, there will be certain industries that do very poorly, and it's very hard to predict that ahead of time. There are some investors that will claim they can, but it's a very risky thing to do that. It's another way of trying to time the market, which can be very, very risky.
Well, do you know anybody who times the market well?
In the research I've seen, it's very rare.
Well, that's the point, that you can't try to second guess it, but you can make some educated assumptions about what may happen and then see if they prove true. If you are, you know, risk tolerant and able to do that with what you're investing in. But as you look at this in a whole, and you look at it now in the global context, what do you think that we need to be looking at with our own markets that are so, in many ways now, tied inextricably to what's happening overseas?
I think that there's some very positive things. If you look at China, it's had some very bad times. There is still some positive growth in China. If you look at Europe, there's been some very positive advancements in Europe. You look at Greece, and they've been able to mitigate some of the risks there, and so there may be some opportunities. Within the U.S., we have still very low interest rates. We have low inflation. We have low unemployment. And so the outlook right now, it looks like there's some very positive things. We know the Fed is trying to slow down the market a little bit. That's simply because, one, they need to raise rates, and two, that you know, things are moving along very, very strongly, and it might make sense to put the brakes on a little bit. We know they're very conscious of that. And so but the outlook is still very, very positive. We're still a very strong economy. We still have a lot of success in the businesses that can be invested in. So,
is it inevitable that the Fed will raise rates, that people should just get their minds around that fact that at some point that's going to happen, and it's not going to be necessarily a call to action to have everything devolve and panic to erupt?
I think the markets anticipate that to happen eventually.
So that's built in?
Yes, that is. That's priced in the markets. Now, if it happens in September because of the crisis this week, or because of the decrease in markets this week, it seems like that may be a little less likely. But we should expect it, and the markets are expecting it. If you look at the interest rates, short-term interest rates, they do seem to predict a little bit of an increase, but it only seems to be marginal. It doesn't seem to be very large at this point.
All right. Well, on that good note, we'll end, and thanks so much for coming in and giving us your perspective.
Thank you.
David Hunter is an assistant professor of finance at the University of Hawaii at the Manoa Schuyler College of Business.
Earlier in the show, we were looking for the nickname of that nearly half-mile-long causeway connecting Quarantine Wharf and Quarantine Island. As the city grew, dredging continued, and Honolulu Harbor was deepened and widened, much of Kohololoa Reef was filled in with permanent dry land. This buried and merged Quarantine Island and Quarantine Wharf into what we know today as Sand Island. Well, Hawaii experienced 10 major epidemics in the latter half of the 19th century. Smallpox, typhus, cholera, even bubonic plague. The 1853 smallpox epidemic alone was estimated to have killed 8% of Oahu's native population. Hawaii health officials in that era attributed most of the disease outbreaks to Asian immigrant laborers, and unfairly, the long causeway became nicknamed China Walk. That's the backyard quiz answer for today, and at 8:47, that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the backyard quiz comes from Achieve 3000, partnering with parents and educators in Hawaii to strengthen the connection between school and home with tools to help monitor students' gains. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii Parents.
Photographers learn to think of light as something they can reach out and touch and even mold to their design. No light matches the warmth of sunlight, and available light can be the best light of all if you know what you're doing. Vincent Versace is a renowned photographer who says natural light is there to be both explored and exploited. He's teaching a workshop on that idea this weekend at UH Manoa's Pacific New Media, and he's on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Vince.
Good morning.
I like that you have a little flyer for your course that starts with a quotation from one of my heroes, Henri Cartier-Bresson. He's kind of one of the gurus of natural light, isn't he?
Well, he's one of the deities of photography, and yeah, he was.
You bet.
He was extraordinary. I also preach this belief. I'm an available light photographer, and by available light, I mean any light that's available, which is also a Bresson concept.
Yes, it is indeed. Well, you know, he was a combination of a journalist, as a photo, you know, a working photojournalist, but he also with a connection to the surrealist art movement of his time and place.
Well, you have to cross-pollinate as an artist, and I think that that's important. I mean, as one of my, for lack of a better word, spirit guides in photography, what I appreciate about Bresson was the fact that it wasn't just the one thing, that he took different photographic disciplines and approached those at a level of, you know, expertise that pollinated and intertwined into all of his other work that he did, and you can see it in the things. It made everything richer by not just being one note. He played many notes. He played many instruments.
Yes, it's all part of not limiting yourself. And also, one of your sort of guiding philosophies here is, and you're going to express it better than I am, but the whole idea of letting the picture guide you, in a sense. How would you express that?
I don't take pictures.
They take you.
They take me.
Uh-huh.
And the thing that I've observed over the years is that the best images are the ones that rip you through the lens, not you trying to drag and picking and streaming through the glass. So if I let the environment that I'm in and the things around me move me, and instead of making the news, I become part of the news, I wind up with far more interesting and better photographs and a better experience along the way.
What's the state of mind that is most conducive to that? How do you get that kind of immersion?
Well, you first have to know your equipment as well as you know yourself. And a big issue I find when I have students on the occasions that I take them out in the field is that part of their thought is that they're going to learn how to use their camera in the workshop. Mm-hmm. And what it should be is you should know how to use that like you know how to use a toothbrush.
Sure.
So that you're not worrying about all of the things that the camera does. You understand all the things that the camera can do so that what you can do is pay attention to what's going on in front of you. Like, I use autofocus all the time. I use zoom lenses all the time. And the reason why I do that is so that I can frame the picture the way I want it framed, and I can have the camera do the focusing so that what's occurring is I'm just paying attention to the subject as it's coming to me, as it's taking me.
Sure. Well, because we've all lost pictures while we were changing lenses, checking exposure, fumbling with equipment in one way or another, right?
Correct. And so the key is to view your camera as the ultimate point and shoot. And what really is important is what's happening in front of your camera, that when you walk into the situation, you're already prepared. You're not adapting to it as it's unfolding. You've already created an environment for yourself that allows you to be adaptable to it as it happens, not trying to put Band-Aids on it as you're going.
The idea is, in a way, what you're talking about, Vince, is kind of purifying the experience where all you're doing is looking and recording, looking and recording.
Correct. That's basically it. It's like you let the picture take you, and the impulse to fire the shutter is when it grabs you. It's like, oh, my God, that's cool. When you're saying, oh, my God, that's cool, that finger should be going down on the shutter, and it should be firing the picture at that moment.
So the reaction and the picture-taking should be one unified act rather than one following upon the other.
Correct. It's at the moment in which you are taken is the moment in which your finger shuts down on that shutter.
Well, because, I mean, did you in your early days have a lot of experiences where you just missed a shot?
Why no?
That
making never you happened to me.
Making you the only photographer in the world to whom that has not happened, right?
Oh, my God. If I had a penny for every cyberchrome I took, and cyberchromes are pictures you take with your mind because you didn't take them with your camera. Yeah. When autofocus came in, that was great. When zooms came in, that was great. And the way we are with the state-of-the-art of the technology aspect of photography, we are in dreamland with
yes.
what can be done.
Well, I think it to understand that, it helps to have started back in the days when every change in focal length involved changing a lens, involved getting an exposure reading, all that stuff, right? It does get you thinking about light and exposure, doesn't it?
Oh, no, I'm don't get me wrong. I'm a classically trained large format view camera photographer that had a archival darkroom and you know, did a two-step development process for printing and deep tank replenishment for his film. And that really informs my aesthetic, and that really informs the way that I shoot. But to
sure.
be perfectly honest, if I never walk into that dark room again, I'm okay.
That is refreshing honesty to hear, because you do tend to be, you have a sort of a film fogey movement, right, where the purists.
Right.
But no, I...
Film fogies. Oh, I love that. I got to use that.
Well, I speak as one. You know, I still have a Leica and a light meter, and I don't know what I'm doing with it because it doesn't make sense anymore. But I agree with you about what the wonderful things that the new cameras allow to do with us. Kind of opens up the possibilities of photography for the future, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I'm a better photographer today because of the technology, because of the 10,000 hours to mastery. The fact that it doesn't cost me $20 a roll of film
yeah.
and having to wait a week to find out if I got anything and then only have three pictures, and that became a very difficult thing to do economically. Whereas with digital, you know, if I want to do 75 pictures of my lunch, I could. Not that I'd recommend that, but.
Well, that's the other thing is preaching restraint. Glad to get a chance to talk to you, Vince. Have a great weekend with these workshops you're doing. Thanks for talking
with us. Oh, I look forward to it. Thank you.
Vincent Versace is the author of From Oz to Kansas, Almost Every Black and White Technique Known to Mankind, and Welcome to Oz 2.0, a cinematic approach to digital still photography with Photoshop. He'll be conducting two workshops this weekend for Pacific New Media. Today and tomorrow, we'll be talking about how to light with a single light source, the sun. You can learn more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Next time on Studio 360, after 50 years in show business, Lily Tomlin says she knows one big thing.
Just barrel through life with all the audacity you can. You'll pay for it, probably, but go ahead and do it.
The brilliant career of the audacious Lily Tomlin. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
This afternoon at 4, following Fresh Air.
Beth Ann, you've had a lot of discussions about cane burning, both pro and con. Do you get a sense that this is moving toward a resolution?
Well, we're going to see what happens on September 16th when there's going to be a hearing on that injunction. That would put a very definite endpoint to some of the activities or to the activities of HCNS, as Rick Vollner said, and as the group Stop Cane Burning would hope.
Well, that's a real, that has an enormous economic impact. Did we touch on that a little bit?
Well, yeah, we did. And if you missed any of that interview this morning with Rick Vollner, the general manager of HCNS, it'll be on the archive in just a little while, and you can go back and listen to it. But that's been the argument, but for a number of reasons, not just because of what has been happening with Stop Cane Burning, but as you heard him say, he and the company has been looking at how to remain profitable. How do you keep current? How do you keep your company moving into the future? That means diversifying and possibly changing what you do, and we'll see what happens with that. But more in the near term, we'll see what happens with that injunction hearing. That's going to do it for us for this week. Coming on Monday, what will Charter Communications' $55 billion purchase of Time Warner Cable mean for you if it happens? Todd O'Boyle of Common Cause says Hawaii customers may not be happy.
And we'll have a visit with Herr Dr. Freud himself. How does that make you feel? While you contemplate that, if there's something you want us to know, you can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Our number is 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation or BKOZHPR.
If you're wondering about the music you hear on the show, find the playlist on our page at HPR2.org. That's where you can also listen back to today's show.
Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozovich. Lillian Song is our producer.
Taylor Rice is our production assistant. Caitlin Ikuma is our research assistant.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vanderkamp.
I'm Beth Ann Kozovich. See you Monday.